Today on Against the Grain, creative destruction is the hallmark of capitalism, as the economist Joseph Schumpeter argued, but the destructive side is often overlooked. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Francesca Ammann about the enormous wave of demolition that accompanied the post-war boom, transforming the rural, urban, and suburban landscape and displacing the residents of scores of communities around the United States. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decades following World War II were characterized by massive demolition on a national scale. To create suburbs, build the new interstate highway system, and reshape cities in the interests of so-called urban renewal, enormous amounts of land were moved and countless buildings leveled by the wrecking ball. Ecosystems were disrupted and neighborhoods, frequently inhabited by African Americans and Latinos, destroyed. No object epitomized that destruction more than the bulldozer, which was celebrated in children's literature, toys, and the popular imagination as a symbol of American progress. And, uninterrogated until now, that powerful machine and the culture of clearance associated with it is the subject of a new book out from Yale University Press. It's titled Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape, and its author is Francesca Russello Ammann. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins me now. Let me start by asking you about the origins of the word to bulldoze. Where does it come from?
Right. Well, that was something that was a discovery along the process. It has these political undertones, and it referred to people who forced people to vote one way or the other. That was what bulldozing was, and sometimes they used violent means to coerce them into those objectives. And it moved over from that kind of political meaning to this technology. But then, as time went on, a technology really imbued with a lot of political meaning itself.
And then what about what we've come to know as the bulldozer? What are its origins?
Well, the bulldozer technically refers to that metal plow that pushes the dirt or other material at the front of a tractor. We often refer to the combination of the pushing implement and the tractor and that plow as the bulldozer, but it's actually just the blade. And it was originally developed for use in agriculture and moves into construction. And then today, that iconic machine really is what we think of when we use the term.
So one of the arguments that you make in your book is that although the bulldozer was not invented during World War II, and obviously all sorts of technologies were produced in the context of that war, often are produced during wars, but that the bulldozer took on a particular almost cultural role, but also was shaped and kind of reshaped technologically during World War II. So tell us about that history.
Sure. So you're exactly right that this isn't a product of the war in the way that we think of, the atomic bomb and some other technologies. But the war was really a critical catalyst for the manufacturers. They really innovated in terms of the technology at the behest of the military, who were putting these machines into practice, building bases in the Pacific, clearing the rubble of destroyed cities in Europe. And it was really just an opportunity for companies like Caterpillar, International Harvester, and others to make their machines faster, stronger, more efficient, because the military depended upon them. And then after the war, the machine that exists for commercial purchase is a lot better than the one that was there before the war. So it's still the same basic implement, but it's better, and its skills are more obvious, both to the public in the United States, to people abroad, too, as these companies after the war internationalized in a lot of ways, too. So it had a cultural significance, elevating and broadcasting the power of this machine, but it also had technical significance, the war, in changing and improving the implement and the tractors behind it and all sorts of construction equipment. I talk about the bulldozer as really the iconic machine, but included in this conversation are scrapers and backhoes and, you know, every kind of construction equipment that went along for the ride, too.
What were the naval construction battalions during World War I, also known as Seabees?
So we know the Army Engineers, which is the construction division of the Army, which goes back quite some time. But the Navy didn't have an equivalent organization, and it was during World War II that they created these battalions. They decided they were necessary in part because of all the overseas bases that were going to be constructed in the Pacific, that they couldn't rely just on hiring outside contractors. They really needed to bring those people into the military. And that's when the Seabees, as they're called, were born. Seabees, an abbreviation of Construction Battalion. And the initial men recruited into these roles were already skilled construction men. So they were a lot older than the typical Army or Navy man. And they brought in that expertise because they didn't have it in-house in the military. Over time, though, as those skilled ranks were exhausted, unskilled men start to come in as well into the CB ranks, and they're trained through their military experience. So as I discuss in the book, the war not only improves the machinery, but it kind of spreads the skill set more broadly among a large number of men, among the Seabees and in the Army Engineers, who after the war have these skills that they can put to use back home.
In your book, Bulldozer, you include, well, many images from World War II of the kind of valorization of these heavy earth-moving machines. Where does this imagery really originate from? Was there active promotion by the companies that were producing bulldozers and other machines that were similar? Or was this part of the war effort propaganda? Where did it all come from?
I guess it's a combination of those things. The companies that were producing the machines, most of their output went to the war. So people back home couldn't really purchase them domestically for commercial use. So a company like Caterpillar or International Harvester or Baker or some of these smaller ones, Alice Chalmers, they would continue to market the exploits of their equipment on the war front, with the argument being that once the war is over, it will be worth the wait. You will be able to purchase a better machine, and look what it's done on the battlefront. Imagine what it will do on the home front. So you have this whole marketing exercise where the companies are very conscious of the fact that the war is going to affect consumers' opinions of these products. They want to keep them top of mind. They don't want the customers to be frustrated. They're having to use this increasingly old and dilapidated equipment that they're even having trouble getting spare parts for. They want to remind them of what their sacrifice back home is yielding on the war front. So the manufacturers themselves spend a bit of money on wartime marketing, and these ads appear in a variety of places, from trade journals that you or I would never see, to Life magazine as well. So they're really widespread, and they're spreading this message broadly. And the military, of course, contributes to this message too. There are embedded journalists who are watching what's going on the battlefield, and they are reporting too. In publications like Engineering News Record about the exploits of the bulldozer, and you get lots of journalistic articles. They're not advertisements, but they are effectively. And those stories are published in magazines. They get reproduced in books as well. So these stories perpetuate, and they wind up in films and in novels. So the marketing engine produces lots of different kinds of media that ultimately is celebrating the efforts of these machines that truly were significant to the war effort. But without that broadcasting of those successes, I don't think we would know as much about how significant those efforts were.
How did the degree of destruction from war in Europe influence the idea of what might be possible in the U.S.? And more generally, how did the sort of militarized view of the landscape that was shaped during World War II affect what then happened to the United States afterward?
I think the example of the destruction, as you say, the urban destruction in particular on the European front, it was not something that was celebrated right away, for sure. And I don't think, you know, it wasn't celebrated at all. But it did show people the potential that was there to remake cities if we were to clear away the old version of the city and build anew and implement modernist ideas of architecture and planning. And World War II gave many European cities that opportunity to rebuild. So it planted the seed in many architects and planners' eyes of what was possible in the United States. Now, people had been talking about these things for quite some time, going back to Le Corbusier and others who wanted to remake the city for the modern age, for the automobile, and get rid of the dense, more organic forms of earlier cities. So these ideas were present, but the war showed the example of what actually could happen. So it was really inspirational in certain ways. And you had this movement of designers between Europe and the United States, some fleeing Europe because of the war. And these ideas traveled over to the US. So I think the war was really critical ideologically in sowing seeds of destruction as a means towards a clean slate and rebuilding and progress. Again, these are ideas that exist before. People had implemented slum clearance selectively in the United States before, but they hadn't embraced it in such a large way as they would after the example of the war.
Well, of course, the clearing of land, the destruction of pre-existing buildings to build new ones and to create new places, new cities even, the idea of demolition is not a new one. Obviously, before World War II, there was demolition. Why do you think that the period following World War II was so significant? What marks it out?
There are a few factors that really distinguish the post-war moment. And you're absolutely right. We can think about the progressive era, you know, the photographs of Jacob Riis that stimulated tenement reform in the Lower East Side of New York City. And there was clearance for that, the clearance of Mulberry Bend, for example. And then during the New Deal, we also have isolated examples of clearance for public housing. And even Robert Moses got his start before the war, clearing away sections of New York City. So demolition exists as an idea and a practice. But in the post-war period, a couple of important factors really come together to make this a nationwide program of remaking cities. You have the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government provides two-thirds of the funding to cities who are pursuing redevelopment, or what eventually becomes known as urban renewal. And they'll give that two-thirds funding, provided that you clear away as the first step in your revitalization effort. And so suddenly, lots of cities that had ideas about how to remake certain areas of the city, downtown, for example, certain ethnic areas, these ideas existed maybe on a shelf, in a plan on a shelf. But now they had the funding to actually put those ideas in practice. So federal legislation is really key to turning idea into practice. And then combined with that are some of the things that we've already talked about. The example of the war stimulating people to put ideas that weren't so widely tested in the United States into action on the ground. The advancements in technology and skill sets. So you have lots of people who come home able to do this work, eager to apply for all the different bids that are put out by cities to clear away. And then to rebuild. And what I found in my research was that, you know, many of these contractors who are either building, you know, clearing away farms and trees for suburban development or clearing away homes for urban renewal, a fair number of those people have some connections to the war. They served in the Army Engineers, they served in the CBs. And so war, you know, either provided or enhanced the skills that they had at doing these work. So you have the ideology of the war, the technology, these policies that fund it, and then the practice embedded in these individuals who came home from the war effort. All these things come together to distinguish the post-war period as an era of nationwide demolition, not just selected cities who have specific characteristics, but you have hundreds and hundreds of cities participating in this. This was the way to modernize your city in the post-war period. And then remake suburbs as well.
Could you give us any concrete examples of the scale of the kind of destruction that went on to really reshape the landscape of post-war America around suburbs, around highways. What was the scale of the clearing that allowed that to happen?
Well, I looked at census data on the demolition of buildings and found that, you know, somewhere around 5%, 5 or 6% of dwelling units were demolished in the post-war period during the 1950s and 60s. And this is a relatively high figure if you track these numbers over time. This was a peak. But in cities that really implemented urban renewal quite widely, including New Haven, Connecticut, for example, which I chronicle in the book, it was more like one out of every six dwelling units fell. So really dramatic reshaping of formerly dense urban downtowns, really just they were building high-rise towers and sometimes replacing that density in different ways, but getting rid of a lot of the old infrastructure that had been there. So in terms of number of dwelling units, it's quite extreme. But it wasn't just dwelling units, it was also the moving of earth. And really, what I'm getting at in this book is this idea of clearance of buildings, clearance of landscapes in order to build anew. So dramatic volumes of earth that were moved to create large flat space for tract housing in the suburbs, or to build the interstate highways, which I haven't mentioned yet. You know, hundreds of thousands of tons of dirt. Enough dirt on one project that I looked at in Southern California, you know, to fill a football field several stories high each day. And this was going on for decades. And those numbers are a little bit harder to track in terms of the census, volumes of dirt moved. But based on what we can tell in terms of farmland converted to urban use, again, the 60s really are this moment of peak clearance of buildings and land in the United States.
That's the voice of Francesca Ammann. She is professor of city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her book, Bulldozer: Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in retrospect, it's often too easy to think that the way American cities and suburbs, the sort of shape that they took, that came from individual decisions rather than federal policy. But of course, the opposite is true, that they were the product of post-war federal subsidies and policies that shaped, as you've mentioned, housing, slum clearance, highway building. And so I'd like to ask you a bit more about particular policies and the effect that they had. Let's start with the GI Bill of 1944. How did that change the post-war American landscape?
Well, it made it a lot easier for large numbers of people to become homeowners. So it increased the appetite for consumption of new homes. So people like Bill Levitt, who was a CB, in fact, who were building large tract developments, the GI Bill helps to provide a large number of consumers for those homes. And there's always been, not always, but there's been since before the war, the mortgage tax deduction, which incentivizes homeownership in certain ways. But the GI Bill made the loans lower rates, much more appealing for individual homeowners.
And you mentioned Bill Levitt. Can you remind our listeners of his signature, Levittown?
Yeah, so Bill Levitt is famous for the idea of mass-produced suburban housing. So if we think of Henry Ford mass-producing the Model T for widespread consumption, Bill Levitt was the Ford of the house industry. And there are three Levittowns: Long Island, there's one in New Jersey, there's one in Pennsylvania, and there are many more communities that are like Levittown, these small, economically built boxes with a yard and a garage, where people were often moving from cities to the suburban dream, and Levitt and Levitt towns and places like this supplied the units to fulfill the ideas of those dreams. So Levittown is just one example. Lakewood in California is another iconic example, and the GI Bill and various other subsidies for home ownership helped to make these things a little bit more appealing.
And of course, Levittown is notorious because it was also a place not only that gave shape to the post-war American suburb, but one aspect that characterized quite a few suburbs, which was racial segregation.
Absolutely, yes. And that's an important part of the story that I'm telling, is the racial dimension of this experience of post-war clearance and construction. In the cities where urban renewal was being implemented, the vast majority, about 60% to two-thirds of the individuals being relocated as part of this demolition of dwelling units were minorities, and very often they were African Americans. And so they were losing their homes in the cities, but they weren't being given access to the suburban dream of home ownership beyond the city's borders. So it's kind of a double-edged price that's having to be paid. Losses in the urban realm and then denied access in the suburban realm.
So the bulldozer presumably took on a different sort of imagery and a different sort of cultural sense for those people, African Americans in San Francisco or New York, who found their dwellings bulldozed to make way for highways or for so-called urban renewal. Is this also something that one has a sense of at that time?
It's something that develops over time. And one thing that really intrigued me as I got started on this project was knowing now how so many people have come to fear the bulldozer and equate it with a lot of things that went wrong in the post-war period in terms of the demolition of buildings that could have been preserved, the racial injustices, the environmental consequences of this large-scale clearance. We know all that, but how is it that people got excited about it? And there was widespread support for this idea of clearance and the application of the bulldozer in many of these places. When I looked at New Haven, Connecticut, for example, Mayor Dick Lee was overwhelmingly reelected term after term, people believing in this idea of progress through destruction. But as this plan was implemented in practice, the various injustices became clearer, that the people who were supposed to receive better housing didn't necessarily have that happen, that the people who could move into the new high-rise developments that were constructed, they were only really affordable to certain portions of the population in many cities, not everywhere, but in many cities. And so it was the experience of the practice of the execution of clearance that really started to change people's ideas about this machine. And before too long, you have people like Jane Jacobs writing quite eloquently about the wrongs of the bulldozer approach to development, and then everyday citizens rising up in protest as well.
And I'd like to ask you more about that, but just staying with the theme of the federal subsidies that allowed this demolition to happen, can you tell us about the Federal Highway Act of 1956 and what it allowed for, and really the impact socially and environmentally of that act?
Sure. So I mentioned the Housing Act of 1949, by which the federal government covered two-thirds of the costs of clearance. The Highway Act of 1956, under that act, the federal government covered 90% of the costs of highway clearance and construction. So this was even more of a financial incentive to state highway departments to put into action ideas they had about new roadways that they would like. Now, from the top down, there was a map, a set of roadways that would be interconnected to facilitate interstate commerce, but also as a defense mechanism. The idea that if we needed to move tanks and other military machinery in the event of any number of Cold War challenges, that we needed a better system of roadways to make that possible. So it was both commerce and defense that was stimulating this. But that 90% federal funding really spurred states to implement this quickly, to try to get ahead of other states so that they could get the biggest appropriations, and also to build new highways where they might instead have expanded an existing one or invested in you know, mass transportation, public transportation instead. The funding really oriented states towards the interstates alone and towards new routings of interstates. The result was a lot of clearance through cities, the destruction of many homes in the same way that urban renewal was doing. It's a very similar story. The types of neighborhoods that were often targeted for the highway were often those where the communities had the least political power, and those are going to be your minority populations. Over time, these groups challenge, rise up in opposition, and have increasing success in rerouting or halting the highway, the Seminole Freeway Revolts, as they came to be known. But earlier on, that's where the highway was going through. And then outside of the city, which is, you know, the bulk of the mileage, it's 46,000 miles, the interstate highway network in total. The bulk of those miles are not in cities. And there, the clearance that was realized was a lot of destruction of formerly, you know, relatively untrammeled rural terrain. Of course, this is not virgin land by any means, but it was land that hadn't been so developed. And this spurs further development around it at interchanges, but also just the destruction of natural habitats, cutting through hillsides, not just despoiling the vistas that were there, but also damaging the natural stability of the landscape. So the environmentalists really start to push back against some of these development practices too. Not necessarily saying that we shouldn't have highways, although some would say that, but that we need to plan them and execute them in a different way. And I've characterized it in the book as this kind of efficiency-oriented, pretty technocratic approach to planning the highway routes as driven by the engineers, who really did see this complex challenge of how to lay out the routes, and a straight line was better than one that wasn't straight. You could get more for your money. But that over time, in part due to citizen activism, environmentalists, residents who were going to be affected, increasing appreciation for the fact that there was much more that needed to be considered about the animals that were living there, about the people who were affected, and about the choices for the environment, the costs that were going to result from these engineering-oriented decisions.
Francesca Ammann is my guest. We'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about post-war clearance and construction. My guest is Francesca Ammann. She is author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Post-War Landscape. That's published by Yale University Press. She teaches city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So I wanted to ask you about, in thinking about the post-war period in the United States, about the connection between demolition, clearance, and economic growth. In Europe and Japan, the destruction of World War II played a significant role in bringing on intense economic growth after the war with Reconstruction. Obviously, in the United States, although a participant in the war, the landscape of the U.S. was not affected by the war itself, but as you point out in your book, we tend to think of the post-war period as a period of construction, and it was equally a period of destruction. So how do you think we should understand the connection between destruction and economic growth in capitalism and kind of what it tells us more broadly about capitalism and the built environment?
Sure. I think that destruction and construction go hand in hand, but we tend to talk about the construction. And so what I'm trying to do, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, is to open our eyes to the other side of that decision. Construction doesn't always have to involve destruction. We're much more attuned to opportunities for adaptive reuse and preservation today than we were back in this period. But I wanted to shed light on the violence that really was embedded in some of this growth that equals progress, that it's not progress for everyone, and that there are costs of this. Joseph Schumpeter had this phrase called creative destruction, which he talked about capital's tendency to create, but only as it kind of destroyed and ate up things along the way. The built environment really materializes that more abstract theory that he articulated. We can see this in the way that individual communities were consumed and destroyed as part of the process of economic growth or attempts at economic growth for individual cities and metropolitan areas. So in simplest terms, what we see in the post-war period is just a very material representation or realization of these political economic ideas that typically operate more in the abstract.
Sure, and the creation, of course, gets much more celebration than the destruction, particularly mm-hmm. those who are involved in the process. And one of the things that's so interesting about this whole story is, as you say, the process of demolition involves a kind of an intense violence to a place and to people's lives as well. And yet the celebration of the bulldozer and of these processes was quite remarkable and spills over to this day. So I wanted to ask you about that dimension, the celebration in popular culture of the mechanisms that allowed for the kind of clearance that you've been describing. You open your book with a description of the 1951 young adult novel titled Bulldozer, written by a former ad man for the Caterpillar Tractor Company, Stephen Meter. Can you tell us about that book and what it represented?
Sure. Meter wrote a lot of young adult novels, but this one was about two friends who, young men on the brink of full-fledged adulthood, who start a little business based on a bulldozer that they find abandoned near a pond, I think, while they're out enjoying themselves one day. Ducky, who's one of the friends, had served in the war, actually working with bulldozers, and he sings the praises of Caterpillar and its machines. And then his friend actually is the one who goes on to start the business. And so the book is this kind of inspirational tale for young readers about entrepreneurialism, hard work, the value of American-made technology. But for me, what I really appreciated when I found this young adult novel was how it demonstrated the faith and the optimism that Americans had at this time for the machine, for technology, and for opportunities in the construction realm in terms of post-war American progress. And it was just one example of many that I found in various forms of popular culture of people subtly and sometimes not so subtly celebrating the machine and its potentially violent applications. So I also found many children's books, so not for young adults, but actually for very young readers, talking about happy, friendly bulldozers and their operators, a book called Buster Bulldozer, Benny the Bulldozer. More well-known are some books by the author Virginia Lee Burton. Hers are a little bit more complex than some of these others, and they tell multiple sides of the story. But many of the books are very much, quite simply, a celebration of these machines, of construction work, of the building of highways. One of the books is called Let's Go to Build a Highway, and it ends with asking young readers to come up with other places that they'd like to see a highway. And there's nothing inherently wrong with any of these things, but just the abundance of celebration of this work without carefully probing any of the consequences of what was being lost and what was at stake in clearing away and building so much in cities and suburbs. And only over time, it wasn't until the 60s, the later 60s, do you start to see some other books talking about people resisting certain kinds of environmental damages. A book about a young girl living in Manhattan who's Hispanic, whose apartment building is going to be demolished, and the trauma that causes for her. Books encouraging recycling, basic things like that. These aren't the dominant trope in the early post-war period. And so this got me thinking about the different ways that these ideas are embedded in the broader culture beyond people who are inherently talking about and interested in the capabilities of a caterpillar bulldozer. This is seeping out much more broadly to young readers, to their parents as they're reading with them, and spreading a very positive message without more introspective thinking about what's at stake.
And this era also sees the rise of Tonka toys and all mm-hmm. sorts of little toys that generally are being marketed to little boys more than little girls. But it's interesting that although you argue that American society's view of the bulldozer has shifted over the decades, children's books and toys today still continue very much in that vein, celebrating bulldozers and excavators and road pavers and rollers. Why do you think that hasn't really been affected by, in the mainstream anyway, by shifts in attitudes around the bulldozer?
I think there's just something very exciting about the raw power, the beauty of the technology behind these machines, the excitement of seeing construction in progress, kind of what's going to be there, what's going to be new. There's something very exciting about those things. In the same way that when you think about the automobile and people are much more attuned to the energy side of the story, through to the pollution, but still people get excited about car ads. There's just something about some of these technologies that appeals to us innately and is marketed in a way that makes it appealing. Also, I think just the glossing over of the undersides of some of these things, you know, stories that feature bulldozers, they often do focus on the construction. It wasn't the typical book that was really celebrating the wrecker, although I did find some like that. That wasn't the norm. It was very much about the new post office going up, the new highway. So they simply skip over the more contentious parts of the story. So they're not necessarily making people celebrate that today, but they're helping people to overlook it. So that's a story that I think continues to be more easily swallowed.
Well, that's the bulldozer and similar earth-moving machines in popular culture. What about high art? How did the clearance of the post-war period and the vehicles that were used to do so, how did that influence particular artists?
Yeah, one of the things that I discovered in my research was really just how widely the influence, the cultural influence of the rise of these machines spread. And so if children's books are one end of the cultural spectrum, changes in conceptual art in the 1960s and 70s are kind of the other end. And I looked further into the work of people like Robert Smithson and other artists who are part of the Earthworks movement, who were able to pursue different kinds of artworks because of the capabilities of these machines. So they would go out, for example, into the desert and build, dig deep holes and make art out of the earth, recognizing the great potential of these machines to create art. But often there was a criticism embedded in this work, thinking about how these things will change over time, the disruptiveness of them. So calling attention to this work by leaving the holes empty rather than covering them up with some new building. Other projects of demolishing buildings and capturing those on video, slowing down the process of this work. So they would use the implements, but they would make us stop and think about them a little bit more. And one of the skills of construction workers and equipment is just the speed at which they work. Before you know it, the building is down, you know, and the new construction phase has begun. And so what these artists were doing, Gordon Matta-Clark as well with his work in cities, were slowing time down, forcing us to stop and think and look at the impact of various types of construction equipment. So this is a much more critical body of cultural work versus the children's literature I was talking about before. But both ends of those spectrums kind of transformed by the changes in terms of technology in the construction world.
I'm speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape. Her name is Francesca Aumann, and the book is published by Yale University Press. She teaches in city and regional planning and historic preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. So you have been discussing the policies and practices following World War II into the 50s and 1960s. You've alluded to it a bit, but I'd like to ask you particularly what was happening in the 1970s around this push to clear and construct new buildings. Obviously, a lot changed in the 1970s, including the post-war boom sputtering out with the economic crisis of the early 1970s. Cities were changing and environmentalism was surging. How would you depict the shifts that were going on in that decade relating to the heretofore positive notions, at least in the mainstream, of clearance?
I think it's really, you know, the late 60s into the 70s that we see some big transformations on multiple fronts. It's 1974 when the funding for urban renewal projects dries up. So projects that are in progress continue, and they go into the 80s, but you don't have new projects funded. Instead, spending on urban development shifts to a more ground-up approach, community development funding, such that citizens are given a much greater role in having input to what the plans for their neighborhoods would be. So it's very different from the top-down approach of urban renewal, whereby, you know, the planner, the grand hand of the planner comes in and wipes away what was there and plans anew. This approach is slower, it's more grassroots-oriented, and it's meant to involve the citizens much more in the remaking of their own communities rather than relocating citizens to bring in new communities to those places. So that's one piece of how urban planning is changing during this moment. Historic preservation also is starting to come into its own. 1966 is the Federal Historic Preservation Act, which is, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that act this year. This act is important for recognizing the significance of individual structures that we should think about protecting before we just tear everything down, but also in providing some subsidies, some tax breaks if you do pursue historic preservation. And so it's into the 70s as this act starts taking root quite a bit more. You have figures like Jane Jacobs, who I mentioned earlier, who really is one of the vocal individuals behind this idea of asking the community what they want, keeping in place, you know, the mixed-use urbanism that planners had been wiping away with urban renewal, and also in lobbying for preservation. So those two stories right there are really interconnected. And on the environmental front, similarly, you know, environmentalism is having starting to have its day as well, as you have the first Earth Day celebrated. You have the National Environmental Protection Act gets passed, which says that before doing any really large-scale federally funded construction project, you need to assess what the environmental impact of that will be. So we need to think in advance about what the consequences of this are going to be, see if it's worthwhile, discuss ways of mitigating some of those damages before a project will be approved. And all of these things, on the one hand, some of them change what's going on in terms of the kinds of development practices, construction practices that are being pursued. In other ways, they just slow things down and give more time for discussion and debate before the wrecking ball or the bulldozer is set free on some of these sites. So it's a change in who's involved in the conversation, in weighing the costs, expanding our view of what the costs are of this work. That really pushes back quite a bit against what the bulldozer is able to accomplish. Similarly, on the highway front, too, you have much of the interstate highway system in place, and the government starts funding a little bit more other uses of transportation dollars towards other modes of transportation besides just highways. So more expansive thinking, more citizen participation, and more recognition of the widespread costs of this approach to building and unbuilding.
Well, World War II, as you have mentioned, was crucial in being the spur, providing a sort of upgraded technological base for the demolition of the post-war period. What role did heavy earth and tree-moving equipment have in the Vietnam War, and what was the cultural reaction to such equipment in the context of such an unpopular conflict?
Yeah, I kind of bookend the book in certain ways by these two conflicts. If World War II provided an opportunity for the bulldozer to take center stage and really show what it could do, and then come home and be redeployed for domestic projects, the Vietnam War was a bit of the opposite. You didn't have the same rallying around the war in the same way that you had during World War II. It was a much more divisive conflict. But construction equipment played a different kind of role. In clearing the jungles of Vietnam, you had massive machinery, tree crushers and the kinds of things that really didn't have so much application back home, maybe to clear land for the building of a dam, but they weren't the bread and butter kinds of machines that were going to, you know, inspire Americans at home to remake their communities or be redeployed there. So it's not that technology stopped improving during this period, but it kind of advanced to a scale and a level that wasn't as relevant for domestic applications. So you lose that kind of technological compatibility in the Vietnam War. And the war also, as I said, is not as widely embraced. And even construction workers become more contentious figures during the war as they sometimes get wrapped up in battles, you know, on the street between protesters and construction workers and which side of the war they're on. It all just becomes much more diversely political versus the more singular way in which World War II played out, if I can simplify things a little bit. So it's not the kind of war that's going to continue to advance the prowess of this machine. And in fact, it kind of starts to get people a lot more skeptical and critical of the ways in which militarized ideas and practices are being deployed in domestic life.
Well, staying with the connection between such equipment and war and political conflict, the killing of the American activist Rachel Corrie by an Israeli bulldozer, which was made by the U.S. company Caterpillar, got great attention around the world when she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian house. How do you see the role of bulldozers today in political conflicts?
It's really, the bulldozer has become even more of an icon, I think, today because of the way that activists have really turned it into a material enemy, standing in front of these machines as they did during urban renewal. But in the case of Rachel Corrie, as you mentioned, actually, you know, being killed, not by design, but falling to the hands of a bulldozer. It's much more obviously political in its valence today, as epitomized by events like this. I think also the application of bulldozers to clearing away squatters in countries around the world today, too, only adds to the kind of negative baggage that's associated with the machine. And Caterpillar, the company, of course, distances itself from some of these applications, that they are just the manufacturer and certainly not condoning or even arming these machines in certain ways that they're being deployed in some of these places around the world. But there is much more criticism of the explicit violence that's being imposed.
Well, finally, let me ask you whether what you term a culture of clearance, which is how you talk about the post-war period, spanning technology, ideology, policy, and practice, is that culture of clearance beyond us now, or does it continue with us in different ways?
What I've termed in the book at the end is that we're moving towards a culture of conservation rather than a culture of clearance, but we're not there yet. While many of the acts that I talked about from the post-war period are over, those sources of funding have dried up, and we have a more nuanced view, widely accepted nuanced views, I think, of the costs and benefits of different types of development, anti-sprawl activism, a real criticism of urban renewal kinds of approaches, the rush to demolish and the optimism embodied in that clean slate, the potential for new development, hasn't entirely gone away. We can see this in selected cities, places like Detroit, where there are many buildings being demolished. And for Detroit, this is a high point for the destruction of its built environment. And the clearance of dilapidated structures is seen by some as a positive first step forward. I see this as different from what happened during the post-war period because these are isolated locations, several of them. I mean, there are post-industrial cities throughout the country who are experiencing these kinds of problems and turning to demolition to try to eradicate them. But we see, again, the repetition of some of the things that happened in the post-war period, this rush to clear without a clear plan for what's going to come next, the psychological damages of vacant lots where nothing is happening, where people may have had some productive uses going on in some of the structures. The costs of doing this work, again, it couldn't be accomplished without some grants, and cities that are obtaining grant funding for demolition are the ones who are able to accomplish this. So to some degree, it's repetition of what we saw before, the same struggles of what do you do with all the rubble and refuse from the demolition, and the same kinds of challenges being repeated, but it's not nationwide practice today. And I think we've learned to be skeptical and critical and to stand up for people who may get in the way of the bulldozer. Many of the structures being torn down in places like Detroit are vacant structures, which is quite different from the people who are inhabiting, you know, the homes in New Haven and many other cities that were demolished for urban renewal. So there are different challenges there. So to answer your question, it's complicated. It hasn't gone away. It's changed. But we can still see some vestiges of the culture of clearance in children's books, in the embrace of demolition as one of the keys to the revitalization of some of these cities. And I think there are still lessons to be learned.
Francesca Aumann, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance in the Postwar Landscape, that's published by Yale University Press. She is Assistant Professor of City and Regional Planning and Historic Preservation at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.